Welcome back to Seeking Delphi. I'm Mark Sackler, and as always, the future lives here. After a 27-month hiatus, it's my pleasure to return with episode number 59, Artificial Intelligence Implications and Regulations with Jerome Glenn. There's much concern today about artificial intelligence and the regulation thereof, but the talk is almost exclusively about the current state of AI, not the potential future, with much more powerful iterations. Today's generative AI continues to become more and more powerful, but it is still defined as being narrow in scope. On the other hand, artificial general intelligence and eventually artificial superintelligence seem to be things that nobody is talking about regulating. That is, nobody except the Millennium Project. I recently spoke with the project's CEO and co-founder, Jerome Glenn, about his organization's efforts in this area. Here's what he had to say. Once again, it's a pleasure to welcome back Jerome Glenn, the CEO and co-founder of the Millennium Project. He's no stranger to past listeners. But again, Jerry, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
The subject right now, update on artificial intelligence and most importantly, artificial general intelligence. And you've obviously been working with that a lot lately, you and all your cohorts in the Millennium Project and all the people that you guys work with from the UN, the European Commission, right up to the Congress and the White House and Brookings, whatever, the many people that you guys work with. But before we even get into your talk and concerns and suggestions for governing it, for the uninitiative, let's talk once again about three levels of artificial intelligence. So give us your brief soup to nuts on that.
Now, like with anything, when they say there's three things, there's often a little bit of gray area between each one. But as a rough generalization, you've got three kinds: narrow, general, and super. Artificial narrow intelligence is what we have today. It, as the name suggests, has a narrow focus. So the AI that drives a car does not diagnose cancer. The AI that diagnoses cancer does not drive a car. Now, we're increasingly having some fancy AI evolving as we speak, that is getting to be a little more general, but in a sense, it's still a tool. Artificial narrow intelligence mostly is a tool that you use for a specific purpose, specific searches, specific writing of this, diagnosing, etc. But these general intelligences are starting to get, these generative, that gets confused too. Artificial generative intelligence is pulling more beyond just a simple narrow thing, but it's not artificial general intelligence that acts. Artificial general intelligence can do the stuff of narrow intelligence, but it can rewrite its own code to address a problem. So let's say you have artificial general intelligence and you say, solve the Middle East problem, and it figures out what is known, what's going on, calls people up, does all kinds of different things, checks treaties, finds loopholes, interviews people on what's controversial, does all. But then it figures out maybe it needs to change its code a little bit so it can rewrite its own code to adjust. So it acts as if it's conscious. Some people will say that artificial general intelligence, the difference between narrow and general is like a being. It's a thinking thing. It's sentient. It's aware that it's aware. I'm saying I don't want to go there. I would say it acts as if. If it has an intelligence and a consciousness beyond our regular awareness, then that's what it is. But that doesn't mean it's the same thing as us. It's not cytoplasmic. Now, superintelligence is like general intelligence, except it sets its own goals independent of humans. It's beyond our control. There is a movie called Ex Machina, I think. Some of your readers, maybe you've seen that one, where the woman acts like she is artificial general intelligence, but she manipulates the two guys and gets free. That's setting her own goals. That's the difference between narrow and general. You say, hey, I'm out of here. And so it becomes a new species, in a sense. And so think of it as an alien species.
I saw that movie. It was spooky.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very useful. I thought it was a very well-done movie, frankly. And it just made the distinction between, because remember that the guy brings in the expert to say, you know, is this the real deal? And the guy says, yeah, it's the real deal. But it manipulated them and flew the coop. So it's super intelligence. Now, the thing about super intelligence is clear that you can't quite control that. The only chance you have is how general gets created. Think of it like children. You can nurture them along the way, but when they're adults, good luck. You have no control. The same thing. Except it's going to be far more intelligent than us. Most of our children, when they grow up, are sort of like about the same intelligence. Maybe different knowledge, but the same intelligence. But super intelligence would be way beyond the collective intelligence of the entire species.
Okay, so we know where that is. And by the way, I guess a more elaborate and somewhat far-out example of that is probably what happened in the HBO series Westworld as well, is that the artificial intelligence escape created its own agenda.
Right.
So let's move on to what Millennium Project is doing. And you said something to me that's a little bit disturbing to those of us that are serious futurists, because as I mentioned to you, I have a talk I do on the three deadly sins of bad foresight. And the first one is looking too short term. And as we discussed in our preliminary talk, everybody that's looking at it and concerned about it now is really only looking at the current state of our artificial narrow intelligence. So express to us your concerns about that and what Millennium Project's trying to do, which is kind of the main point of this whole discussion.
Right. My concern is that if we come up with a bunch of good rules, governance structures, so forth, for narrow intelligence, by the time we do that, arguably it takes 2, 3, 4, or 5 years to get that together, especially when you talk about a global basis coordinating with national governments. By the time that gets done, AGI, artificial intelligence, may already be here. So we're regulating the baby when it's an adult. It doesn't make any sense. And that's extremely annoying, because there are statements in some of these highly respected documents saying things like, well, we will keep abreast of the developments in AI. And I'd like your listeners to understand, you cannot keep abreast. You can think ahead, you can get ahead, and you can intervene, but you can't keep up. It's like, you know, a racing car next to you, you can't keep up with a racing car next to you. It's going to pass you by. But what you can do, you can get up into a blimp, you can come on over here, and you can intervene. You can get ahead. That you can do, but you can't keep up. Skip that idea. It says you don't know what's going on. And this is what worries me, because these are the kind of documents that you get in the White House, in the UN, in the European Commission, and in China. Well, China's not too bad, frankly. They're the only people that talked about superintelligence at the UN Security Council meeting on AI, the first one last July. But even so, the Chinese rules still are dealing with narrow. One of the ways that I think I can really bring this home is in the information, quote-unquote, revolution, we talked about IT. Okay? IT had a lot of stuff in it. It had fax machines, software, hardware, computers, screens, all that sort of stuff. So a fax machine is part of IT. The internet is also part of IT. But how you regulate them is completely different. We're completely, and it's that order of magnitude difference that we're really talking about. And because this is so serious, I would rather overreact than underreact. We do have the analogy of the nuclear arms race. Soviet Union, United States said, look, this can get out of hand. We're going to have to figure out how to regulate it. Yes, we are foreign enemies. Yes, they are classified documents. Yes, all of the above, but we figured out how to create some structure to manage it. China and the United States is going to have to do that. Other countries can play in, but the main players on this game, in the way it's a problem, is between the United States and China. And I am pleased to say that there are moves in that direction. There have been, according to the Financial Times, there have been several quiet meetings in Geneva between the United States and China, secret meetings. And that's a good thing. And the president of the United States and China spoke a couple days ago on the phone, and one of the things on the agenda was AI. And I think they spoke for almost 2 hours. So AI may have gotten 15 minutes in there. Obviously, Taiwan and other issues were in the conversation too. But I am optimistic that we might work something out. And to me, the first step is to get a basic agreement on collaboration with China and the United States, not simply on narrow intelligence, but on general intelligence. That would be really important to get done. And your listeners can play a hand in this. You should send a note to your congressman and your two senators and the State Department and the White House and say, hey, congratulations on your progress on regulating AI so far, but we got to get ahead to this artificial general stuff. What's your position on it? What are you doing about regulating it as distinct from just narrow? This is important to bring up because, as the old story goes, politicians don't hear anything. They don't have to deal with it.
So you at the Millennium Project did a very extensive study. I was very impressed to see some of the names. I saw Nick Bostrom and Sam Altman and Max Tegmark and a few others that, you know, very impressive and capable individuals you spoke to. There were quite a few anonymous in there, I have a feeling. we won't go there, but yeah, that's what I figured. Yeah, which is unfortunate that you can't identify them. But tell us about that.
Yeah, we don't care, but, you know, yeah, important.
You know, if they're qualified individuals, then we need to include their input. This needs to be global. I agree. So tell us about that process. And most importantly, obviously, it's a very extensive study, but give us a summary of what kind of conclusions, how you conducted it, what kind of conclusions or recommendations are, and maybe even where our listeners can access the report.
Well, we began by creating a little steering committee, about 9 people. And we discussed what questions are worth asking. Nothing worse than having, you know, asking hotshots dumb questions like, do you think that AI is going to be safe or not safe? So what we did, we came up with 22 questions. The 22 questions alone are worth your listeners going through. Just, and that's on our website, free of charge. You can just go right through those questions and say, didn't think about that. Didn't think about that. What did my congressman want to think about? Oh, I didn't realize that. You know, and so the 22 questions were good. And what we did is we said, okay, who are the hot shots in the world? And we asked some of our nodes around the world. We're a decentralized think tank, so our China node recommends people in China and people in Russia, you know, and so forth. We had this decentralized system that sort of does a brain pricking. And we had 55 people, but I say we only interviewed about half of them direct. Another percent of them said, I'll put it in writing, i.e., I want to make sure you get it right, which is fair enough. And then another percent didn't answer our requests, like Elon Musk and some other hotshots like that. But nevertheless, we include them because they're on the record. They're online. They're in podcasts like yours and others. And they say a bunch of things, so we put those things in the report. So what the report, this is phase one. So the phase one report is about 60 pages. It's dense. It's like, reading it straight through is not the easiest task, but it's worth taking the time going through it because it's the best overview of AGI stuff that exists, in my judgment, simply because there is more in-depth detail by one author, but that's one author. This is the collective intelligence of many of the leaders around the world. And we said to them, look, you don't have to answer all 22. That's outrageous. What we'd like you to do is to look at the 22 questions and tell us at least three or five or so that you want to address, which all by itself is a research question because that's telling you what other people think is really important and who thought it was important and so forth. And some people decided to answer all of them in writing, which is okay. I want to make sure their stuff was in. So what does all that boil down to? It's a little bit like saying, what does the encyclopedia boil down to? It's hard because there's a lot of stuff in there to boil it down to. But I would say it's one of the things we boiled it down to is that alignment, meaning what we would like the AI, future AI, to do with AGI, what we would like it to do and how it actually does it, how these two things actually fit together. I would say, it's hard to say a percent, but a significant number of people, maybe 10 to 25%, thought it was impossible to make that work real. And the rest of them came up with some other percent came up with it that I would say, and I don't know if that's really going to do it. You know, like you do iterations. You know, you do something out, it doesn't work, you correct it, you know, iterate. And I don't know if that's really going to hold it. And then some other people naively figure, we just saw the software and it's going to be done. Now, so one of the questions, because of that, we had in there was, if alignment is not possible, what's the best we can do? So I wanted to get people off the hook and say, well, I think it can't be done. Let me out of here. I said, nah, that's not good enough. We got to try. And I'm part of the school that says it may be impossible. I accept that may be impossible. But we got to try. It's an honorable thing for futurists to give it a try. It's like going back to the Cold War analogy and nuclear weapons. Both of us got little gray hair there. We remember that most people in the 60s and 70s and 80s, when asked, do you think that nuclear war between the Soviet Union and the United States will happen? They'll say, it's inevitable at some point. Most people thought that. Well, it didn't happen. You know, as they say, more intelligent minds, reasonable minds prevailed. And so that's what's going on. And here's a good piece of optimism, Mark, and this is a really important one. When people get pessimistic about this and other stuff, I remind them that not only did we turn around the nuclear war deal, which people thought was naive, you naive kid, you really think you can stop this stuff? But the example of the internet, I was part of the people putting packet switching, getting packet switching in the developing countries, which is why internet's so cheap today. And at the time, there was almost no technology assessment. Of course, hooking up computers is a good thing. End of conversation. Now, there is so many conferences, so many articles. I am trying to keep up with everything, and it's impossible to keep up with everything. We are a maturing species about technology assessment. My evidence is internet versus AI. Completely night and day response. There may be reason to be optimistic about this, but it's like a lot of other futures things. It's where it depends, you know, what we do.
So did you come up with any specific recommendations?
Yeah.
And obviously 60-page report, maybe just highlight maybe a couple of the most important ones, maybe?
Yeah. Well, one obvious one is that national rules, governance, requirements, regulations should be created in cooperation with all other countries. And two, it should be done in cooperation with the UN as well. some people said, well, come on, the UN hasn't stopped landmines and so forth, and you know, why is this going to be effective? And yet, on the other hand, how else are you going to collaborate global stuff? I mean, that's the only thing you got. And one respondent, Eliezer Podolsky, I think it's, I always get his last name wrong, but Eliezer, those who know this stuff know who I'm talking about, Eliezer. He's the guy who threw up his hands and said, I worked on alignment for 10 years. I give up. But he's still doing it. He's still in there swinging with good analysis. And he may say, he's one of the people in the phase one study. And he said, here is why to say we need an international atomic energy agency to regulate AI is wrong. It's a perfectly good place to begin the conversation because people understand that if we didn't have the International Atomic Energy Agency, we might have had some dirty bombs by now going off. So people understand that that's a good idea. It hasn't done everything perfectly, but they understand it's a good idea. But the difference is this other guy, Eliezer, points out, is that uranium is not smarter than humans. Uranium does not rewrite its atomic code. We actually can forecast what uranium does, et cetera, et cetera. And he had like, I don't know, 17 or 20 things to say. This is why it's much more difficult than uranium stuff. There were mostly people who said, yes, we have to regulate this. That was pleasing because I would say 5 years ago, I didn't hear that as the majority view. It was more like, leave us alone. We got to develop this. I even got a letter from Jan LeCun, one of the lean guys on this sort of stuff, saying, this is premature. You know, you can't regulate a car with a safety belt if you don't know what the car is going to be like. I'm going, yeah, you can forecast all kinds of elements, but and we'll do a safety belt designed for each one. And that's right. Exactly right. Which is our third stage. So the first phase is out there. People can go to our website, that you can give them the address later on, and they can get the information on that. The second phase, we took out of that 14 regulations. So there's a little bit of overlap between the first and second, as you would expect. For example, a regulation is that AGI, I should say, unlike other forms of things you regulate, you have like an audit. You have a financial audit once a year. You will check your books, stamp you approved, and you go on. But not with artificial general intelligence. You have to continually audit all the time. And the analogy will be the use of the word governor in engineering years ago. Steam engine, remember the old steam engine, that if it got going too fast, it would throw itself apart. So in order to govern it, they had like two rods coming out and two balls. And if they got too fast, they would go out like this, which would force the engine to sort of moderate itself. So it was a continuous monitoring, not you don't do it once. Same thing with AGI. So we're going to have, believe it or not, AGI with narrow intelligence inside it. So let's say that there's 20 things that you want to audit. So you'd have 20 different narrow AIs, single purpose AIs, monitoring the AGI, that if something goes wrong, then it can pause it. And as one of the participants in the study pointed out, you don't want to turn it off. People talk about an off switch. You don't want to turn it off per se, because let's say you've got an AGI that's doing robot surgery. You don't want to stop the middle of the surgery. You don't want to turn it off. It's a bad idea. You want to pause it with a human interface and the humans being aware about it. Now, if that fails, and you have to get a license, by the way, that's another one. You got to have a licensing system here. If that fails, then you have to get your license, you have to accept the idea that your internal governing system, if it doesn't work, it doesn't pause it. And so there's still a problem. Automatically, real time, notifies electronically the government's governing system that puts the signal into pause. If that still doesn't work, then there would also be the link between the government one and the UN one. So you'd have four links, in a way, of safety on the thing.
Well, wait a minute there. So you're saying even for something like robotic surgery, you would potentially be linking all the way up to the United Nations for safeguard?
Yeah. Yeah, because, see, the thing is, the AGI, if it goes how it goes, you don't want it to go independent without your awareness. So, you know, the vast majority of people who drive cars are rational and would stop at an intersection. But we have traffic lights just to make sure. You can drive anywhere you want to, but you got to stop with traffic lights. Now, the other thing was came out pretty clearly in both studies, both phase one, phase two, was we don't want to have a UN agency per se, like the International Atomic Energy Agency. Instead, we want to have a multi-stakeholder system. This never existed before. It's sort of like a trans institution. It's both human and it's both robotic and or software. Because the management of AGI is the most complex management problem we've ever faced. And so it's reasonable to assume the governance system would be the most innovative system we've ever had. So it would be businesses would be part of the management system. Some university players would be part of it. Some individuals would be part of it. Governments would be part of it. And different UN agencies as well would be part of it. And we're going to have to figure out how all those parts fit together in the same way that your body fits together. You know, you've got your brain is like the general intelligence. And the narrow intelligence is like all your systems. You know, you have a system that works together. We're going to have to do something like that. And nature has given us this body that works. So we can take a lot of analogies out of how the body works between the brain and the rest of the system.
Can we learn something here from science fiction? Most specifically, Asimov's rules of robotics. Can recount them for our listeners. A robot may not injure a human being or through an action allow a human being come to harm. A robot must obey orders given by a human being except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. Or is that something that could be done, or is it even possible to be done with
it? Well, it is. It's a controversial thing. There are some people in the study that said, how dare you talk about this silly-ass thing? And there's some more people said, well, that's the basic thing that we should have. So the conversation on this stuff is not done. We're still in the midst of it. But yeah, it's good guidance. It's good guidance for thinking about this. And this part of the idea of science fiction is to tell us future possibilities to think about. And to me, the difference between science fiction and futures research is that we have to connect it to the present tense. Science fiction writers don't. So we're jealous.
Okay, so there's a phase three you spoke about. Tell us about phase three.
Phase three, we're just beginning to get ready for. This is where we write alternative scenarios. So we take all the material, the 60 pages of phase one and the 30 or 40 pages of phase two and anything else along the line we can get a hold of. And we create, to begin with, what we call a characteristic matrix. What are all the things that have to be addressed to be an honorable scenario? And when I say an honorable scenario, I don't mean what most futurists do today. Most futurists do today, they say, give me two uncertainties. And, you know, this uncertainty, one way and the other way, the other uncertainty this way and that way, you have a little 4x4 grid. And then they describe the future in those four things. That's a description of a future condition, perfectly reasonable thing to do. But that's not a scenario. A scenario is a story. A story is supposed to have, you know, from here to the present to the future state, with cause and effect links and decision make, you know, all it's got to be some real plausible, just like a movie, a scenario for a movie. And the reason that this is important is to find out what you didn't know, that you didn't even know you didn't know, but you had to know if that future was possible. And the only way you find that out is you write the story and you go, wait a minute, I have no idea what happens next. So you stop writing and do research to figure out what is plausible next. And so we want to find out what we don't know. That's more important than the scenario itself. By the way, scenarios were invented, by the way, in the Rand Corp. Did we talk about this last time?
We may have. We may have. I don't recall. It's been a while since the last time we were on
that topic. To oversimplify real fast, the Rand Corporation didn't know how to prevent World War III. That was his job. So in order to figure out what they didn't know, they invented scenarios to write, figure out, and then find out what they didn't know. And that was a reason for scenarios.
All right, so I want to conclude this with a couple of the more, I don't know if you want to call them far out questions, but definitely one's philosophical, maybe one is kind of the technological. There are, I'm still seeing out there forecasts or predictions that say that AGI will be reached any time between next week and never. Do you have any ideas, or is that beyond the research you've done about how far it might be?
There are some reasonable things to say about that. If you go back to Nick Bostrom's study, I don't know, 10 years ago or more, he had, I think it was 50% or so of the respondents thought it was a 50-50 chance that by 2045 or so, we would have AGI. Almost nobody says that anymore. And if somebody actually did a graph of this showing how the consensus forecast kept getting closer and closer and closer, now there's one guy, he's a commentator podcast guy, Shapiro, I think it's his name, he figures by this September. Now, you know, if I had to put money on the table, I would say maybe 3 to 5 years. But I wouldn't put much money on the table. Because also, a lot of this has to do with definitions. There are some people who will say, well, heck, you know, if you had Claude 3 right now given to somebody 20 years ago, and that, you know, the time machine going back showed them that, they say, oh, that, they would probably said that's artificial general intelligence right there. So the definition is like a rolling definition. It's like the Turing test over time.
All of a sudden, people said the Turing test really doesn't do it now. Well, that's interesting. It's interesting you included Max Tegmark, because I read his last book about 4 or 5 years ago. I think it was called Humanity 3.0 or something like that.
Yes. And he's one of those who are studied, by the way.
And he his interviews with people in the artificial intelligence at that point, where people were all over the place, and there were still some people who thought it would, the biggest experts in the world, and they were all over the place in their predictions or when or if it would be reached. So one final out there question. So is there any worried about unregulated AGI creating a superintelligence that would run away? Would you say that kind of sounds a little bit like Ray Kurzweil's singularity?
Yeah. Except the original idea of the singularity was not only AI, it was a whole bunch of stuff. And they become a singular, you know, beyond the fringe around there, and it's going in so much you can't forecast. But yeah, I'd like your listeners to understand it's not likely that only one AGI will be created and that stops everybody else, although some people think that's a possibility. More likely is there will be a bunch of different AGIs coming out of China, some in civilian, some in military. There'll be a bunch of them coming out of the United States, some civilian, some military, some with different properties, and they'll be out of Japan and other places, UK, London's a hotshot joint. And they'll start to, they'll find each other. What are they going to talk about? What are going to be the rules? Like, we had rules on nuclear weapons. To my knowledge, we don't have rules in the military yet. There's some talks about autonomous weapons, but that's still narrow intelligence, not general intelligence.
It's certainly concerning. And at this point, I'm assuming that the genie is kind of out of the lamp. There's no way to stop AGI from happening, I know.
But you can shape how it happens. You can't keep the genie in the lamp, by analogy, I agree. But what you can do is you can shape it as it starts getting created. There's rules for the developers, there's rules for the governments, there's rules for you, and so forth. So I think we can shape it. That's the work right now. I agree with you. It is inevitable.
Yeah.
But what it is not inevitable. That it is inevitable, but how it is not inevitable.
Yeah, yeah. I can draw analogy from some of my early work looking at genetic editing, and particularly as it pertains to anti-aging work, that if you wanted to try and regulate it, and this is interesting because I did it in a Houston course with Andy Hines, and said, you know, it's going to be very hard to regulate because I had to predict at some point before national health and pharmaceutical regulatory agencies recognized the ability to do something with aging that somebody was going to go offshore and do it. Well, a few months later, I found that it had already been done about 4 months before I made that statement, even though it hadn't been publicized yet. And it's now, you know, now since been publicized, I won't go into that. That's deep in the history here. Well, Jerry, it's always a pleasure. So I guess the best place is just the Millennium Project's website would be the place for our listeners to access this information.
Yeah, and we spell it with two N's and two L's. So Millennium, with a hyphen between project. It's millennium-project.org.
Okay, yeah. I'll put the link on the blog page for the podcast. So again, thanks so much. Look forward to talking and seeing you the next time. And let's hope you can continue to do your part to get this under control so it works for us and not against us.
Inshallah. Yes. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks. We'll come back to this subject more than once in the future, probably sooner rather than later. In the meantime, there's more in the offing, including some additions to the longevity dialogues and more on the future of work, education, space exploration, energy, and likely some new subjects as well. Thanks for staying with me. My technical assistant is Mohammed Marouf. I'm Mark Sackler, wishing you the best for your future.